WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. On a hot summer night in 1930, 16-year-old James Cameron was nearly lynched in Marion, Indiana, by a mob of Ku Klux Klansmen and their sympathizers. Cameron was sent to jail, charged with a murder and rape he did not commit. He was sentenced to 2 to 21 years and served 4. In 1993, Indiana Governor Evan Bayh granted Cameron a full pardon. This week, James Cameron died at the age of 92 after a long illness. James Cameron founded America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee in 1988. One photograph in that museum is of the mob in Marion, standing under Mr. Cameron's two black friends hanging from a tree. It became one of the most infamous and most reproduced American lynching scenes. Guest host Marty Moscoane interviewed Cameron in 1994 when his book A Time of Terror was published. They spoke about what happened that August night in 1930. James Cameron told her he was riding in a car with two young men he knew from the neighborhood, Thomas Shipp and Abraham Smith. Smith said they wanted to rob someone. This is what happened next.
Well, I wanted to get out of the car. I didn't want to have anything to do with them. So they kept on driving. They wouldn't stop the car. And we drove out to a place past the 38th Street Bridge and the Soldiers' Home and down a lane called Lover's Lane. And there we came across an automobile that had been parked on the sidelines, and there was a man and a woman in the back seat. Now, on the way to this car from Thomas's car, I had a feeling of something inside me saying, go back, go back, go back. But I kept following them as if I was tied to them. I don't know what it was that drove me. Maybe it was the idea that I wanted to show them that I was as brave as they were or what. But I kept right on following them as if I was tied to them. We came to this car, and they pulled a gun out from their pocket. Thomas had the gun in his bib overalls, and he handed it to Abe, and Abe handed it to me and said, here, you hold him up. And foolishly, I walked up to the car. I said, stick him up. And the people got out of the car, and I noticed the man when he got out, and I noticed the woman when she got out. Her face was pale and lovely and frightened. And as soon as the man got out of the car, I recognized him immediately. He was a friend of mine.
Someone, you had a shoeshine stand.
Yeah, I was his shoeshine boy. He was a young man, 23 years old. I was 16. And he'd always tip me and laugh and talk, and he wouldn't let anybody shine his shoes but me. I came to my senses at that particular moment, and I turned around, gave the gun to Abe, and I said, here, I'm not going to have anything to do with you guys. And I left. I ran down the road as fast as I could go. And it was dark that night. I stumbled and fell, but I had run about two or three blocks away from the scene of the crime when I heard some shots said, bang, 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 just like that. And I had been foolish, I know, but I had not been trained to be an insane person. I was not about to go back there to see who was shooting who. So I kept on running until I got home. And when I got home, my mother was standing up. She was sitting up waiting for us. She never went to bed unless all her children were accounted for. When she opened the door, I stood there sweating and panting like a horse that had been in a race.
She knew something was wrong.
Yes, the way I was gasping for breath and everything, and the look in my eyes. You know, a mother can look at a offspring and tell when something's wrong by looking into their eyes. She knew something was wrong. She asked me, what's the matter? Are you in some kind of trouble? I said, no, Mom. I've been playing football over in old man Henderson's field with the boys. She knew I was lying. She said, go on upstairs and go to bed. I'll talk to you in the morning.
Now, the police arrived at your house in the middle of the night, banged on the door.
Yes.
Came and dragged you out of the house. Mm-hmm. What did they say you had done?
When they awakened me upstairs after Mother let them into the house, they came upstairs and pulled the sheets back off me where I had tried to hide myself, but I could still feel the beams of their flashlights coming through the sheet. And they pulled the covered back and told me to get up and put my clothes on. I got up and put my clothes on very shakingly, tremblingly, and one of the police said, "Have you told your mother what you and those boys done tonight?" I said, "No, I haven't done anything." And he said, "The hell you haven't," said, "you went out here and you shot a white man and you raped a white woman." And I said, "Oh, no, I don't know anything about that." And they said, "Come on, the chief wants to see you." So they took me downstairs, and downstairs my mother was having fits. She was acting like a crazy woman. She was saying, "What has my boy done? Lord, have mercy, forgive me, help me. Jesus, what has my boy done?" She was telling the police that, "He's my only son. Please don't take him. What has he done? Take me instead of him." Mm. And when I look back at it now, and I see my mother standing there in the doorway, wringing her hands and telling the police to take her instead of me, I can never forget that. It just comes back to me all at once.
Well, certainly the way you're talking about it, it sounds almost as like you're reliving it, that the memory and the details are so powerful.
They are powerful. When a traumatic event happens like that to a young person, or even to an older person, it makes an indelible mm-hmm. imprint on the mind.
Now, you were taken over to the police station and interrogated there. Describe what the interrogation process was like.
Well, the police station interrogation process was nothing at all. All they asked me was my name and address and where I lived. That was what the sergeant asked me in the booking room there at the police station. But outside the police station, on a flagpole, was the shirt of the victim who had been shot. The white man who had been shot, his bloody shirt was hanging on the flagpole of police headquarters there in Marion, Indiana, for the whole city to see.
And that was a kind of a flag, a call to action.
Yes, kind of a waving a flag in front of a bull, waving a red flag in front of a bull, that's what you might call it. And after they got to ask me these few questions in the booking room there at police headquarters, they allowed me to go into a room where the sheriff was sitting down at his desk. And when I went in that room, the sheriff told me to have a seat, and I had a seat. He said, "Do you know Thomas Shipp and Abram Smith?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Were you with him tonight?" I said, "Yeah, I was with him for a little while." And he said, "Where'd you boys go? What'd you do? How'd you meet him?" And I told him all about how I'd met Abram Smith and Thomas Shipp that night at a place where we were pitching horseshoes, and I was ready to go home, and they offered me a ride. And he says, "Anything happened while you was in the car?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Abram said they wanted to hold up somebody and get some money to buy a new automobile." And I just told him I didn't want to have anything to do with anything like that, so I tried to get out of the car, but they wouldn't stop the car. And the sheriff said, "Why wouldn't they stop the car?" I said, "I don't know. They kept on driving." So he said, "What happened when you got out into Lover's Lane?" I said, "Well, we went through a dark thicket part of the brush, and we came upon a car that was parked on the road. And I said, they told me to go and hold the people up, and I told them that I was scared to hold the people up because what if the people in the car had a gun?" And they said, "Oh, no, they haven't got a gun. So we'll stand over here on the side, and we'll make out like we got a gun, too." So very foolishly, I took the gun, and I walked up to the car, and I said, "Stick them up." And that's when the man and the woman got out of the car.
Did the sheriff believe you?
He did not believe me, no. No, he didn't believe me. The police pounced on me and almost tried to kill me right there. Then after they tried to kill me and didn't succeed in doing that, they grabbed me and threw me in the chair alongside the desk where I had been sitting and talking to the sheriff. And then the sheriff put a piece of paper in front of me, and he says, "Here, sign this." Well, my mother had always told us to always look at something before we sign it to see what we were signing. So foolishly, I looked over and tried to read what the sheriff had written down on the paper, and one of those policemen hit me upside the head. It felt like a wrecking ball up against a building somewhere. I saw a million stars. He knocked me out of my seat, and I hit the floor. They snatched me back up and threw me in the chair and said, "Damn it, the sheriff said, sign it, not read it."
So what did that piece of paper say? What did you sign?
I didn't find out what it said until a year later when I had my trial. It said that Thomas Shipp had killed the man and that Abram had raped the woman. But the thing of it is, at my trial, a year later, the woman said she hadn't been raped. Hmm. That was why the judge repudiated the conversation and threw it out.
Now, after this interrogation, you were locked up in the jail. When did you notice a crowd begin to gather around the jail?
The very next morning, when daylight approached. See, I'd been arrested on the evening of August the 6th, 1930. And by the time they put me in jail, it was around 2 a.m. And when they put me in this jail, I was in there about 3 hours from 2 to 5 talking to the men that were in the cell block where I was incarcerated, because they all crowded around me and wanted to know what was the matter and what had I been arrested for and what had I done and all that. So I told them the same thing I told the sheriff. I didn't know anything about I should have kept my mouth shut or nothing like that, you know. And when I got through telling my story, they said, oh, hell, I wish I was out of this here place. Because there was 30 black men in there who had been caught riding the train through Marion, and they had been given 30 days for vagrancy in the city of Marion, Indiana.
Now, when this crowd began to gather, did they have signs? Were they shouting things up to the jail?
No, they were just shaking fists up at the jail and looking at the windows and everything like that. And they were gathering in small knots of people, 8 to 10 people at a time, and the crowds kept getting bigger and bigger all during the day.
We'll continue with James Cameron's story after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to guest host Marty Moscawen's interview with James Cameron, recorded in 1994. He died earlier this week at the age of 92. When we left off, he was telling the story of how he was nearly lynched at the age of 16, accused of a rape and murder he did not commit. An ugly mob had gathered outside the jail where he and his friends, Thomas Shipp and Abraham Smith, were held.
Now, this crowd broke into the jail. They took Smith and they took Shipp first before they got to you.
I was a cleanup target.
You watched them drag these two men from the jail. What did you see?
I saw them beat him unmercifully. They beat Tommy first. The amazing thing is they took Tommy out of his jail cell block, beat him to death right there in front of my eyes, and then they drug him around to the side of the jail and hung him on the barred windows of the cell block where Abram was incarcerated. And no doubt Abram was looking out the window and seeing them hang Tommy on the windows of his cell block.
You knew that Tommy was dead?
Oh, yes. We knew that Tommy was dead when they drug him out of sight because someone had ran a crowbar through him several times.
Now, you said you watched him knowing that you were the third person in this group. You watched knowing that you were next.
No, I wasn't next at that time. After they got through hanging Tommy on the window, they came back and got Abe out and hung him. And then they came back and took Tommy down from the jail window where they'd hung him and drug him through the streets like a dead horse. These 16 and 17-year-old white boys did that. And they drug him up to the courthouse tree and hung him alongside of Abe. And after 15 or 20 minutes of having their pictures taken and everything, beside the two bodies that were hanging on the trees, they came back to get me.
And you describe hearing the chants, "We want Cameron, we want Cameron."
That was the second time after they failed to get me the first time. The first time they came up to the jail after they had hung Abe and Tommy on the tree, they came back up to the jail and they told us to divide ourselves and get on each side of the cell block. So about 15 or 20 blacks got on one side of the cell block and 10 blacks and these 4 whites got on the other side of the cell block. And the mob came in and said, "Cameron is in here." I said, "Where is he?" Now, in these 30 men who had been caught riding a train through Marion and given 30 days in jail for vagrancy, one of those men had a 16-year-old son, and he was my age, my height, my complexion. We could have passed for twin brothers. So much did we look alike. Well, at any rate, the mob was questioning this young kid and asked him his name. He told him his name was Charles Haynes, and they asked me my name, and I told them my name was Henry Burton. I wasn't about to tell them my name was James Cameron after I'd seen what they'd done to Tommy and Abe. So just then the sheriff came in, and he told the mob, leader said, come on, let's get the hell out of here. So you've already hung two of them, so that ought to satisfy you. And then the mob turned around and went back downstairs, and they told this 15,000 to 20,000 people out there waiting for my presence that Cameron's not in there. And they said, yes, he is, and we want him. And then they began to yell for me like a favorite basketball or football player. They said, we want Cameron, we want Cameron, we want Cameron. And I thought I would die.
Mm. Well, they did identify you and dragged you from your cell. You describe people beating on you, children spitting on you as you were dragged outside.
And as the police cleared the path through the mob so I could get up to the tree, which was just one block away from the jail where Tom and Abe were hanging, as the police cleared the path, I looked over into the faces of people as they were beating me along the way up to the tree. I was pleading for some kind of mercy, looking for a kind face, but I could find none. And they got me up to the tree, and someone said, where's the rope? They got a rope, and they put it around my neck, and they began to push me under the tree. And that's when I prayed to God. I said, Lord, have mercy and forgive me my sins.
Now, I'm sure you've been asked this before, but what were the thoughts that moment before you thought you were going to be hanged?
Well, I was ready to die. I wanted to leave a world full of so many false and deceitful people. I was ready to die.
But you heard a voice. What did the voice say?
The voice said, take this boy back. He had nothing to do with any killing.
Did anyone else in that crowd hear that voice?
No. 4 years later, after 1 year awaiting trial and then 4 years in prison, I came back to Marion, Indiana, and I asked people, and they said, you were just lucky we didn't hear any voice.
Mm. So the crowd, the frenzy of the crowd died down?
Oh, yes, in an instant. And no human voice, honest to God, could have quelled the fury of that mob that night. It had to be a miraculous intervention.
And the crowd literally parted as you stumbled then back to the police station.
Yes, half a block away. And the sheriff was out there, and he said, I'm going to try to get you out of here for safekeeping. Well, hell, it was too late for that. The decent-loving white people and blacks had been calling him up all morning, telling him to get us out of there and take us down Indianapolis for safekeeping. But he wouldn't do it. Of course, I found out later after I got out of prison, and I went back and started questioning people about it, reading all the newspaper accounts and everything, and then from what I could remember myself. So I wrote a book about it, A Time of Terror.
And once you were released from prison, you went back and interviewed people that might have been there knew were there?
That I hoped I might find somebody was there, and I did. I found a lot of people.
Did you find people wanted to talk about the lynching?
Yes, and I found some that didn't want to talk about it.
You also write that while you were in prison, a number of people, both black and white, came to the prison to apologize for what happened.
Yes, you'd be surprised. I was really surprised. So many white people came and apologized. They were sorry and all that.
Was that enough?
It wasn't enough, but it helped.
Mm-hmm. Now, where did you get the idea for the Black Holocaust Museum, which is now in Milwaukee?
My wife and I were traveling several years ago, in 1979 to be exact, and we visited the Jewish Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem. And when I came out of there, I was so emotionally disturbed I couldn't hardly talk. But I told my wife, I said, honey, we need a museum like this in America to show what had happened to us black people and freedom-loving white people who've been trying to help us in our fight for equality in this country.
Now, where do you get the artifacts and what kinds of...
People send them to me. People send me artifacts. They look up in their closets or in their trunks and find descriptions of lynchings and pictures of lynchings. They find books about black and white people that they haven't used for years, and they send them to me. Even white people send me things. I have Ku Klux Klan robes and skulls, you know, gold skulls that they use for tie pins or lapel button. Wallets and belt buckles and a whole bunch of stuff.
You were pardoned by the governor of Indiana last year in 1993, the state saying that they had forgiven you.
Yes.
Do you forgive the state?
Yes, I did. You should read my acceptance speeches in my book, A Time of Terror. they have an appendix in there, the speech I made when I accepted this pardon that Governor Edward Evan Bayh had so graciously bestowed upon me. I told them that since Indiana had forgiven me, I in turn forgive Indiana for their indiscretions.
Well, I thank you very much, James Cameron, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
James Cameron speaking with guest host Marty Moscawen in 1994. Cameron died Sunday at the age of 92. His book, A Time of Terror, is currently out of print.